Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders!
Woohoo!
Woohoo! I'm Justin Burt, joined tonight by our wonderful producer, Sydney Engel. Dr. Chris Two-Man Two may join on later. We'll see. It's a surprise. But Sydney, how's it going?
Doing great. How about you?
I'm good. What a great episode. This was excellent. Our guest tonight is Dr. IJ Anosik. She was a star coming here to discuss EBV. It's a great episode. Before we get into that, though, Sydney, do you mind telling us about our show? Just tell us about the show.
Absolutely. We are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the field to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answer lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
That's right. And we had a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. IJ Anosik. Dr. Anosik earned her medical degree from Stony Brook University School of Medicine and her MPH in clinical effectiveness degree from Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. She completed her pediatric residency at Brown University. What up? And her fellowship in pediatric infectious disease at Boston Children's Hospital, Harvard School of Medicine. During the earlier part of her career, Dr. Anosik practiced as a primary care provider and served as a clinical director both in the U.S. and abroad in Tanzania, caring for children and adults with HIV/AIDS. And in 2020, she joined the Children's Hospital at Montefiore as an assistant professor of pediatrics and director of the pediatric antibiotic stewardship with an interest in antibiotic and antimicrobial and diagnostic stewardship, QI, and education. She's the recipient of several teaching awards throughout her career, and it's no question why she was a star.
Dr. Anosik teaches us why EBV serologies may trump the monospot test, about how the scratch test can identify splenomegaly in EBV, and how clinicians can use diagnostic stewardship to determine when to pull the trigger on a full lab workup. So, without further ado, let's get to it.
Sydney, I know about you, but I feel like this episode, it was great. It really hits the monospot. It's the spot. It's the monospot. Yeah.
Oh, I like it. All
perfect.
Right.
All right. Great. So we'll go ahead and get started and say, you know, welcome to Dr. IJ Anosik. Welcome to the Cribsiders. We're excited to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
This is amazing. I think this is going to be a great episode. We're excited to have your expertise and talk all about EBV. Before we get started, though, we're an informal group. We talked, is it okay if we call you IJ
throughout the... Of course. Yes.
Perfect.
Yes.
We're already close friends, the four of us on the show. This is going to be great. I would love to get to know you a little bit more. Our listeners would love to get to know you a little bit more. And so can you give us a little bit of an introduction about yourself and maybe something you're interested in or excited about outside of the field of medicine?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, first of all, everybody asks me where IJ comes from. So I will say that I usually introduce it to our more medically inclined people as I as an ice cream, J as in, internal jugular, IJ as internal jugular. But for our less medically inclined people, I said ice cream and whatever jack that you want to put that in.
So nice.
Whatever the case may be. And I love all things art. Wise, I'm really, really keen into doing all kinds of photography, still life photography, candid photography. So it's really my passion, what I do on the outside. And I also used to sing in an a cappella group. So I do a lot of still singing.
Wow.
In my time that I have off.
What was the name of the a cappella group?
The Valsalva.
Oh, no way. That's awesome.
I knew it was going to be good. One of my trouble stories of my troubled youth, obviously, was one summer I went to photography camp. And this was one of the biggest times I got into trouble as a kid was during photography camp. We snuck out to go to a coffee shop across the street, got caught, and they called our parents and we had to get sent home. And that has been like my, I've just worn that...
That
trouble, yeah, exactly. The label ever since, and that's what got me into the criminal legal system, which is where I do a lot of my work now. So that was the inspiration.
I had no idea.
I know. I'm happy that I can share that vulnerability with you all on this
on
this call
now.
Today. Yeah, we're friends now. That's right.
Okay, my question: since you like photography, what are your favorite focal lengths and why?
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm going to be very honest with you. So I think I have been sort of the modern photographer. And I will say that because I actually get a kick of using sort of the cell phone photography at this point.
Dope.
So although I don't have a lot of knowledge in terms of all the various nuances of photography, but I get a kick out of playing with shadows on my cell phone. And there's been some really great work, some of which have actually been published in some of the books as well too. So cool. Yeah.
Very cool. I mean, they say the best camera is the one that you have on you, right?
So I'm telling you, that's how I get a phone. I want to know what the camera is like.
There's like documentaries now that are completely filmed on 100% phone cameras. It's 100%. Amazing technology. It's way better than
crazy.
Like that.
Yeah. It's crazy.
No, they have motion pictures that are
done motion pictures.
Yes. Yeah. Not just documentaries. Like
yes.
Wow.
That's true.
I think Dune 2 was actually entirely filmed on an iPhone. No. I think it was all iPhone. Nope.
Don't hurt me like that, Justin.
Oh my gosh.
I can see the billboard now. Dune 2 shot on my iPhone.
Denis Villeneuve is gonna roll over in his future grave.
Oh my gosh.
IJ, can you give us a piece of advice you've learned to add to our collection?
Oh my gosh. Advice, I guess, in my career wise, you know what? You know how people used to say or would say, don't change yourself. But I think in medicine, I don't really subscribe to that. I think in medicine, and I think you intend it to be a transformative experience. So if you're really not changing, you're not growing. So for me, I think it depends on sort of the space that you're in. So I think we should be ever evolving, even though I understand the premise of saying, don't change yourself was to be true to self. But I think in medicine, we have to always be ever evolving.
I love that. I love that medicine as constant learning, as constant professional growth. I have certainly changed over the medical career. And I think for the better.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Absolutely.
My humor probably hasn't improved much. But well, that was a lost cause. So. Well,
Hey, Cryptsiders listeners, let's talk some more about Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. So here's the backstory. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Erez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Erez, selfishly, it could mean that he would spend more time with Gabby, who was spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. So what does Freed do? Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, no extra mental burden. All the magic happens in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. So Freed is this AI scribe that makes charting go away, doing your soap notes for you. It is HIPAA compliant, takes 30 seconds to learn, and costs only $99 per month. But you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. That's freed.ai. And listeners of Cribsiders can use code CRIB50 for $50 off their first month.
Well, this is great. I'm excited to dive into some content. Sydney, do you want to get us started with our first case so we can start talking about EBV?
Yeah, let's jump in. All right. So you are seeing 15-year-old Mo for a chief complaint of fever and sore throat. He reports feeling sick for about the last week. Initially, he just felt achy and tired, but now he has a sore throat and fever. On exam, you notice 3+ tonsillar swelling with moderate exudate, as well as significant cervical lymphadenopathy. His lungs are clear to auscultation, there's no rash, and you are not able to palpate his liver or spleen. His temp is 101.6, pulse and respiratory rate are normal. He denies any sick contacts at home, but he says that people at school are, quote unquote, always sick. So our first question for you, kind of, we like to start by framing the topic that we're going to discuss. So can you just give us a brief overview of the epidemiology and pathogenesis of EBV and infectious mononucleosis, and also maybe just help us with what terminology we should be using of, is this EBV, is this mono, are they the same thing?
Oh yeah, totally. So I mean, what the case that you're presenting here is a pretty classic case of what we would consider to be infectious mononucleosis. So infectious mononucleosis is the disease manifestation of the virus called Epstein-Barr virus. So although they're used interchangeably, the correct terminology or correct use of it would be, this is an EBV infection called infectious mononucleosis, or for short, mono. And in a case like this, mono is particularly very common and it's pretty ubiquitous. It's actually a virus. It's one of the herpes viruses. For those of you who don't know, there's multiple viruses that are herpes viruses that we know, HSV-1, HSV-2, but this happens to be also an HSV herpes virus itself, type 4. And in fact, it's a pretty ubiquitous virus that you can see pretty much anywhere, everywhere, and it's often very much acquired by close contact to an individual who is actively shedding. The interesting things about this virus is that the virus is actually stays in the saliva for hours upon hours, even in asymptomatic individuals. So you may not even know if that you're infected or not, and it's really pretty much all throughout the world. So there's really no predilection to a geographic location or seasonal time of the year. It's just hanging out anywhere looking for the unsuspecting individual to infect and to replicate. So this is what I would say in terms of pretty much the epidemiology of this virus. And for the most part, it can infect anyone. It is not differential to your age. It can infect the young and the old and the active and the less active. Anyone is susceptible to this infection. So that's pretty much what it is. And as I said, because it's a virus, the virus really looks for an opportunity to gain access in the body. And this particular virus, interesting enough, it actually infects one of those cells that we have that we call lymphocytes, and more in particular, the lymphocyte is actually called the B lymphocyte. So for those of you who remember, the B lymphocyte particularly is important for making antibodies. And we also have the T lymphocyte. So where this particular virus resides is it hides in the B lymphocytes itself, and it replicates, and its idea is to use the body, the actual organs within the T lymphocytes that typically will make antibodies, and use it for itself to actually generate more of itself. And that's what causes the disease, because those lymphocytes go to various different organs of the body, including the throat, which is why you have the pharyngitis that he has, and then including also the lymph nodes, which is why he has a lymphadenopathy, and then other organs, including the spleen and the liver, which is where the lymphocytes house themselves and get clean from the body. So that's really where the pathogenesis of the virus is.
So with our presentation here, would you consider this a what we call a typical presentation? And if so, like, are there atypical types that may be harder for us to catch on examination or by history?
Yeah, totally. This is what we would call a typical case of infectious mononucleosis. We usually call it sort of the three, the classic triad. So the classic triad is the fever, pharyngitis, and more classically, the pharyngitis is exudative, meaning that there's actually a pus-filled pockets in the tonsils themselves, and they are extremely swollen and extremely painful. And then you have the lymphadenopathy. And so you can see where it says the cervical lymphadenopathy. Interesting enough, more classically, the lymphadenopathy involves the posterior cervical chain, more so than the anterior cervical chain itself. And that's just where it's draining. And so that's what we call the classic triad for a typical case like this. Now, there are atypical cases. And the atypical cases that you may see is that they may have, and this is more typically in older individuals as opposed to children, you'll see that may present with significant abdominal pain. Now, if they're presenting with significant abdominal pain, you may see that they may have a hepatitis associated with it. So their liver enzymes will be elevated. Or that may represent that the spleen is so large that there might be a splenic rupture. So you're thinking already, oh my gosh, this might be an appendicitis, when in fact it's actually an EBV splenic rupture. And then there's other things that can be associated with it. Differences in sort of how you think. So CNS manifestation. So you can get an aseptic meningitis. You can get an encephalitis, and a really cool syndrome. This is a really cool syndrome called Alice in Wonderland syndrome. That has been one that's been associated with EBV. And it basically is just a change in the way you behave. It's just sort of delusions of grandeur. Interesting enough, that often can be confused with a psychiatric condition, but in fact, it's actually an EBV infection. And then more rarely is when you'll see some tumor-associated or cancer-associated manifestations, i.e. large tumors of the face like Burkitt's lymphoma, or persignificantly sick individuals with different disease manifestations of the hematological oncological origin.
This is really fascinating. I think it's great to, you know, talk about all the different presentations, and it's helpful to have this kind of pathophysiology understanding of where the virus is replicating and going. One question with this case, when I first read it, you know, it's a person with a sore throat, a fever, cervical lymphadenopathy, exudative pharyngitis. Mm. My first thought is this is 4 out of 4 center criteria. This is strep throat. And so I'm curious if there are thoughts of when a patient has a typical presentation of something like acute pharyngitis with fever and some of these symptoms, are there specific things that you're looking for in exam or history to differentiate from things like strep bacterial pharyngitis or, you know, thinking about what would guide a next step of a workup to really start saying this is infectious mononucleosis and not some other viral pharyngitis and not strep pharyngitis?
Absolutely. And I think that's an important one, right? And particularly important, as you said, Justin, with group A strep, i.e. strep pharyngitis, that's very common. And we've seen really high cases of that as of late and during the post-pandemic COVID era. So I think the things that you really want to look at is, as you mentioned, the center criteria, you know, strep pharyngitis should be very high on your differential when you're thinking about infectious mononucleosis. But what really distinguishes it is the absence of URI symptoms. And so with the center criteria, that is classically something that is a part of that criteria, is that there's an absence of URI symptoms. That may not be the case often with this infectious mononucleosis. You may absolutely have URI symptoms with that as well too. And it's not always reliable to use that as a criteria, but for the most part, that's what you should be seeing. And then as far as looking at other potential ways to distinguish it, unfortunately, it's a little bit difficult because you can have a group A strep present with abdominal pain, but more so with hepatosplenomegaly, like the enlargement of the liver and the spleen, you shouldn't be able to see that with group A strep. Now, there's other things that can look very classically like EBV, such as CMV, and CMV can cause a pharyngitis, but I will say that's very uncommon to see in an otherwise healthy individual. So you're not going to see that much. You might see that in an individual that is immunoimpaired more than so than a healthy individual, because CMV is also another virus that is pretty ubiquitous and can cause a pharyngitis, but not in an exudative process like this, and also not very common in a otherwise healthy individual.
Excellent. And so it sounds like, you know, one of the things we're thinking about or ruling out some of these other cases, let's say with this case, we have someone who's been sick for a week, has some generalized symptoms and does have URI symptoms. So we listen to this podcast, so we're ready to start thinking about EBV, infectious mononucleosis. Can we tell the family, listen, you know, this kind of sounds like infectious mononucleosis. That's what the diagnosis I'm giving you is. I didn't feel your spleen, but my exam skills aren't that great. Don't play football for a few weeks and send them out. Or how do we then take the next step of confirming? Is there any role for testing or blood work or other testing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you said try to avoid any sort of contact sports. I think it's better to err on the side of caution than not. But I think to make you feel a lot more comfortable as a provider is you can do testing. So now the classic testing that is available that is relatively non-cost prohibitive and available and rapid, you can get it within minutes, is what we call the mono test. Now the mono test is what is called a heterophile antibody test. What the heck does that mean? So what that really means is essentially you are testing to see if the body has elicited a response, and the response is the production of antibodies as their fight against the virus, right? And so essentially it is actually equine erythrocytes that agglutinate with the actual substrate, which is your antibodies. And so if it clumps up, then you can actually see that the test is positive. But here's the caveat. The caveat is the timing of when you take this test. When you take this test, you really have to be mindful that there's a potential for a false negative. The false negative often happens within that first 1 to 2 weeks. Beyond that 2 week time frame, that's enough time that your body has had exposure to the virus to now elicit that that antibody response, which again, that's exactly what we're looking for, right? So you want to be able to strategically place the timing of that. So for this kid right here who's had it for about a week, you may see it, but you may not. So a negative test shouldn't make you feel comfortable that you've ruled out the disease, but a positive test will make you feel far more comfortable. So there are other tests that you can do to feel more definitive about the disease.
Sort of in this case, would one also consider maybe waiting another week to testing again? Is there a role for that? I also heard at some point that maybe sensitivity for this test is also worse with younger children, like less than age 4. Can you talk about that as well?
Absolutely. In fact, we actually try to avoid not using the mono test less than 4 years of age because there's a high degree of false negativity. High degree of false negativity, among other things that you can potentially see that can cause a false negative response. So in which case, we don't really rely on the mono test in those studies, and in fact, don't recommend that. Nowadays, actually, there are serological testing that you can get that are really commercially available at many institutions and urgent care settings. So those serological testing include the actual antibody to the viral capsid antigen. We call it VCAs, V as in Victor, C as in cat, A as in apple. And it is essentially looking for an IgM antibody and an IgG antibody. And then there's another test that's called the Epstein-Barr nuclear antigen. Okay, so that really is very helpful. And there's one more other test that is actually called the early antigen. Now, you don't necessarily need the early antigen, but in fact, what's most helpful for you is really those three tests that I just mentioned, VCA-IgM, VCA-IgG, and EBNA, or Epstein-Barr nuclear antigen. Those two, three tests can really tell you whether you have an acute or past infection. Let's make it easy. The EBNA, in general, if it is present at all, present, that almost exclusively tells you that this is a past infection, because that EBNA will not show up until much later on in the infection after the following the onset of the infection. So oftentimes we can see it as early as 6 weeks, but more classically tend to see it as far as 6 months where it starts to peak. And then the IgG can show up very early on an infection, so it won't necessarily tell you if it's early versus acute versus past infection. But with the EBNA, it tells you that this is a past infection. And then IgM classically shows very early on. And when it's present, it almost exclusively tells you that this is an acute infection. So EBNA, so VCA-IgM, acute infection. IgG, the VCA-IgG, maybe a past recent infection versus past infection. And then EBNA, almost exclusively past infection. So the three of them together can tell you what you're dealing with now acutely versus not. You could wait another week if you want to do a mono spot, or you can just do a test if you have it available.
Quick clarification on the mono spot. So which I believe that what you just described was what is included in heterophile testing. So what exactly is a mono spot? How does that correlate with what you just mapped out for us?
Okay, so the heterophile testing, so the difference between the heterophile testing is the heterophile testing is a latex agglutination test. So essentially what you're doing is you're basically taking the patient's blood, and instead of really looking directly at their antibodies, which is what we're testing for what I mentioned with the VCA testing, IgG and IgM, what you're looking to see is taking their blood, their whole blood, and interacting it with equine erythrocytes. These equine erythrocytes are tagged with a little marker. That marker interacts with the antibodies that are sitting in the pool of blood for the mono spot. So you may have opportunities where there's a false positive, false negative, depending on how it interacts. The sensitivity of the test for a mono spot can be maybe sometimes as high as 90%, but it can be really low as around the 50s to 60s to 70%, depending on the time and depending on how much you've mounted an immune response. Whereas now the ones I'm talking about with the VCA, IgM antibodies, IgG antibodies, it takes away the heterophile antibodies. We don't need to worry about it interacting interacting with the other substrate. We're looking at it for what it is and actually assessing the level of titers. How high is it mounted in the individual's body? So that's really the difference. So it's much more of a direct test and it's far more sensitive.
So maybe if I can take this opportunity to try to engage in TeachBat to make sure I get the understanding, because it seems like there's some counterintuitive parts of the heterophile antibody or the monospot test is really checking for relatively acute or subacute infection, while the EBNA, which is an antigen test, is really looking at more long-term exposure. And so because the monospot test might not be available, has the decreased sensitivities, what I'm hearing is really that like the IgM, the VCA IgM is really the best way to check for acute EBV infection causing infectious mononucleosis. Does that sound right?
You got it, Justin. You absolutely got it right on the nose. Woo! Okay.
Excellent.
Very good.
That's great. I have never had it, I think, explained to me so so straightforward as you did, which is really appreciated. And I don't know that I've ever really thought like, oh, antibody, heterophile antibody test, that's for kind of acute. Antigen test is for past infection. Mm-hmm. It feels counterintuitive. So this has been really, really helpful. And frankly, it kind of sounds like if we're only concerned about acute infection, the IgM is the way to go.
The IgM is the way to go, absolutely. And if you, and if, let's say, for example, let's say, what if your IgM, and the reason why we just don't do the IgM alone is because, like I said, depending on when they're presenting, you may have the IgM. The IgM will peak really relatively quickly within that first week, and then it will peak around the 2 to 4 week mark and then sort of drop. So depending on when the person is presenting with you, you may still want to have some context as to saying what might be going on. Many parents want to come in and say, what is going on with my child? And they want to be able to provide some comfort to their child. But you as a provider, you also want to provide them with appropriate advice. So they may be having IgM that may be negative in the moment, but now you have an IgG that is positive, you have an EBA that's positive. You may be saying, okay, this was someone who has symptoms just recently. They may have had a recent past infection. Let me tell them, please don't play sports for a set period of time. And that can give you an opportunity to provide the appropriate counseling.
And so maybe to dive into the details there more too is if let's say it's been several weeks, and the IgM is low, and we're presuming this is because it's now on the tail end, or it's not present. How is there a way to differentiate the VCA titers, or some way to identify that it's more of a subacute or recent infection, as opposed to they were infected when they started making out in high school years ago?
Yes, absolutely. So actually what you can do is, the beauty of this is that many of the tests that we do for the serological testing is actually is quantitative. So you can actually do what we call convalescent serological testing. What does that mean? That basically means is that you do the testing at time stamp one, and then repeat that testing again another few weeks later, oftentimes usually at a minimum of 2 weeks later, and you see if there's a decline in the actual antibody itself. And that may represent that this is actually a resolving infection, or if it's actually increasing, you may see that they're actually going through a point where they just recently had this infection as well too. So that might be helpful. We don't often do it. We may see that we do it in other individuals who are super high risk, immunocompromised individuals. But there's another test that you can do to actually help you to know if there's really circulating virus. So we just talked about the body's immune system and their response. Well, what about the virus itself? And that is what we call a polymerase chain reaction test. That's what we call a PCR. And that is extremely available and is super cool. Molecular testing all the way, okay? And basically what it does is look at the genetic imprint. This sees where if there is any residual virus circulating in your body, and a relatively quick test most places have access to. So you can tell real quick, does this person have a virus still there? Just by doing the PCR test.
Wow. My takeaway from this is I thought there were a lot of tests for mono, and it turns out that there are even more than I thought there were.
Yes, there are.
Let's talk for a minute about the testing in addition to the mono testing. So let's say that there's someone who either you have a pretty high suspicion for EBV or they have testing that comes back with a positive EBNA, maybe a positive IgM. What other blood work would you consider adding on?
I love it, Sydney. That's a great question. So that's really important to really address here because it also is about putting the puzzle together to help you feel with a vote of confidence what is going on with the patient as they present to you. One of the other things that we also like to get is what we call a CBC, so a complete blood cell count. And that CBC, what's classically found in a CBC is that you have what we call elevated lymphocytes. So the white blood cell count often can be elevated. It doesn't have to be, but it can be. And we call that lymphocytosis. Lymphocytosis, more specifically, as it relates to the fact that you have a higher elevation of lymphocytes. And remember, I told you this virus loves to attack and live in B cells, B lymphocytes. The other thing you may see with that is something classically that board questions like to ask about is the atypical lymphocytes. Atypical lymphocytes is just these little immature looking lymphocytes. They can often represent about 10 to about 30% of the total lymphocyte count. If you see it 10% or more, in addition to the lymphocytosis, meaning elevated in general, that can really help you push you over the edge. This is definitely looking like infectious mononucleosis. The other thing you want to think about also too is liver enzymes. So I mentioned before to you that mostly adults can see this, but again, this infection is one of those things that we tend to see mostly in adolescents. This age group is classic for this, particularly in those who are going to college or in military settings because of just how ubiquitous this virus is in close quarters. These kind of individuals can also have a liver involvement, often very mild, where you'll see that the ALT may be a little elevated. And when I say elevated, it's in the hundreds. It's not these in the thousands or things like that, but it can be. And then other labs that you may see sometimes is you may see a thrombocytopenia. And you can see the thrombocytopenia. And that can start to make you trigger, depending on how the child looks like, as an atypical form of EBV, something called HLH. Hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis, a very rare condition of a hematological condition that is a manifestation of an EBV, at least as a trigger, that can reduce all your blood cell lines as well.
So to the point on some of these kind of more scary complications, to what extent would you be trending those labs? So if normal the first time in a patient with a positive EBV, do you need to recheck at a certain point? If they're abnormal, do you need to trend until they normalize? Can you kind of talk about the follow-up there?
Absolutely. That's a great question. So for the most part, for a typical presentation like this, you don't really need to necessarily follow the labs unless they are abnormal, because you do want to establish that they return back to a normal baseline. Right. And so that is usually what the recommendations are, at least for infectious and mononucleosis. If you're looking at the AAP guidelines, also there is the red book that all of us ID physicians like to use. We don't typically necessarily have to do monitoring labs. However, it really depends on the clinical manifestation of the individual. So for those rare cases that I mentioned for HLH, they are classically much more sicker. Or for those who have an oncological process as a trigger or a relationship or an association to EBV, we do monitor those labs much more quicker because we want to see response to therapy as a reflection to labs in addition to clinical response. So for an atypical one, in general, it's not a bad idea to get baseline labs, see how the person is doing. And if you find that there's some abnormal labs with that, then you would want to follow that to normalization. But if they're normal, there's really not a desire or need to really track it, nor do you have to repeat EBV antibody testing as well.
And maybe this has been really helpful of kind of looking at the broad spectrum of labs that we might want to order. And I anticipate, especially if someone's like in the ED and looking pretty sick, we want to do this as a full assessment. Do you have guidance on when to pull the trigger for an EBV panel or some of these other lab findings in an outpatient setting? Is it a certain level of illness? Is it certain physical exam findings? Are there certain things of, should we just be anyone that's coming in with viral pharyngitis pulling the trigger to check for for EBV. What are your thoughts on when do we pull the trigger for some of this lab work?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, because I think at least in my line of work for infectious diseases, and more particularly within stewardship, there is a concept of diagnostic stewardship. So we don't want to do every single test because we just have it. We want to be able to be judicious about what we're doing. So to your point, I think the first thing is really what the patient is presenting with. There are a number of different viruses that can cause a pharyngitis as well. We talked about strep throat. That's a separate test, easy enough to do, rapid strep test. But for viral entities, particularly our respiratory viruses, if there really are in those cases presenting with mainly upper respiratory symptoms and really nothing else that is not exudative process, I don't pursue it that much further. However, if it's exudative and they're expressing significant abdominal pain, or they're really just looking borderline, you're making me nervous that I may actually send you to the ED, it warrants the workup. It warrants the workup, right? Because you don't know that you're dealing with EBV. It could be something entirely different, something really as serious as sepsis. So we also want to make sure that we're doing our due diligence to do those tests. But if a kid is relatively normal, they're able to tolerate food, they can go home, they're feeling fine, low-grade fevers, I'm probably not going to go full court press, maybe do a respiratory viral panel and call it a day and tell them to return back if symptoms worsen.
One of the big components of infectious mononucleosis, is my understanding, is things like the splenomegaly.
Oh, yeah.
And we're gonna talk about some of the complications. Before we get into that too much, though, I would love to know if you have any tips for on physical exam of you know, it's a core physical exam finding that I think really changes the course of kind of what you're thinking. And especially for early trainees, obviously not, you know, like our level. We're old pros. Like Chris and I,
we're
blindfolded. You know, we can measure the spleen in a healthy patient, piece of cake, just eyes closed, touching. But for the other people in the room, any tips on finding the spleen or measuring the spleen on physical exam for these patients?
Totally. And Justin, let me just tell you that. So I lived overseas for a number of years, and you are just using whatever tools you have, which is your five senses. That is it. And so I will say for splenomegaly, the best way to do the exam is really don't start off with that right near the costal margin. Start as low as possible in the inguinal area and work yourself way up, because you may really in fact miss that splenomegaly. The spleen itself has a tendency to grow inferiorly and medially. That's where it has a tendency to grow, inferiorly and medially. So if you are going to start pressing on that left costal margin, you're going to miss it. So what you want to do is you really want to start in the inguinal area right where the groin is and actually work yourself away up from it and doing sort of a wave-like motion against the fat of the skin and their actual organ contents, and you sort of rub against it. Another thing that you can do is what I call the scratch test. And the scratch test is you take your stethoscope, you put it on the belly, and you scratch your finger along with it, gloved. Scratch your finger on their belly, and you can actually hear a difference in the sound of the quality of that scratch, and it starts to dull out along the edge of where the spleen is or the liver, wherever it is. So these were really cool tools that I used when I was working overseas when I didn't have always an ultrasound at disposal.
I love that so much. It's almost like the percussion of the GI.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is that's an amazing pearl. That was such a perfect, exciting answer to the physical exam question. That's amazing.
I think we need to bring you back for a physical exam episode because just having the ability to figure out diagnostics when you don't have the tools at your disposal is something that not all of us have the experience with. So that's incredible.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you become a little bit more confident with it because now your senses are sort of in tune and keen. So I think it's really helpful to be able to practice that as much as possible.
I think we can move on to maybe treatment, guys. We've sort of talked about it a little bit. You know, we brought up contact sports a little bit, and you did say something about, I still don't quite understand, like, how long should we keep people from the contact sports? And it sounds like maybe it may vary based on their presentation and maybe other types of quantitative tests that you're doing. Can you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. So for typically infectious mononucleosis, we want to be able, so in general, for treatment-wise, it's rest where possible, right? So there's really no antiviral therapy that is recommended per the Red Book, even if you use up-to-date as well too, primary literature in general as well too, and from expert opinion. We don't use any antiviral therapy, even though they exist out there. It's really not necessary because this is a self-resolving infection in most healthy individuals. Now, in terms of really anticipatory guidance, what you really want to do is to be able to tell them at a minimum 4 to 6 weeks after the onset of symptoms. And so that's actually what is recommended per AAP guidelines and also the Red Book as well too. And that's usually when you have enough time for the spleen to return back to its baseline. That doesn't mean that they may not experience ongoing fatigue and things like that, but you really want to do 4 to 6 weeks is usually what we typically recommend with the graduated response in terms of increasing their activity level. So we may say 4 to 6 weeks, but just be mindful not to do major activities during that time frame. And then as far as additional supportive care for individuals, managing pain and fever and things like that are mostly important, but there's really no antibiotics. So a lot of times providers and parents may really push and nudge you and say, hey, I want something for this. And you may find in some cases, and what we've seen is you don't really want to give antibiotics. More classically, the antibiotic that you may give and find out an absolute abnormal response is amoxicillin. And amoxicillin is an antibiotic that is often used in cases where you may think that there's a pharyngitis like strep throat. But in fact, what you'll find is you'll more than likely develop a non-allergic morbilliform rash. And that's classic with this and very much a test question that for those of you who are studying. So you want to just be mindful of that. Don't fret. You just stop it. So you don't stop it. You don't continue it. And that will be the end of that. So there's no antibiotics indicated here. You rest for about 4 to 6 weeks, which is the current recommendations. You may do it a little bit further, but at minimum, that is what is recommended.
Can I ask a question? I've always been fascinated by that EBV-related antibiotic rash, which feels unique to that combination. Is there a clear understanding of that pathophysiology of why amoxicillin and this specific virus combines to form a rash? And or maybe is that seen in other ID presentations that I don't see as much, that it just always kind of blows my mind?
Yeah, no, it's a pretty classic one that is seen with EBV infection. And the key there is to say that it's a non-allergic, so it's a non-IgE mediated response. So there's sort of a vascular response that takes place with this particular antibiotic. And when I'm talking about this particular antibiotic, all versions of that, amoxicillin and then amoxicillin clavulanate, those are the specific things. And really the understanding of it is sort of this sort is sort of a vascular response to this particular penicillin group. And it's very classically associated with EBV. We don't really tend to see it a lot outside of other types of infectious etiologies, i.e. spirochetal infections, where you get something called a Jackson-Hyme response to that. So in essence, this is very unique to EBV.
So we would see this only in our beta-lactam. So, you know, so many urgent cares, I know, because I don't know who the makers of azithromycin, but people always want to give a Z-Pak for everything.
Oh, yeah.
So I know people show up in urgent care, they all get a Z-Pak. So if they got a quote-unquote Z-Pak and azithromycin for people who don't know what that is, they wouldn't have this type of reaction. Is that correct?
That is true. We don't tend to see it as much. Now, I mean, and it's rarely been associated with azithromycin. Now, I will tell you, in my own personal practice, I have seen a case of that, but I question if that in fact was the azithromycin or some other entity that was going on that was a viral exanthem. So the thing is you may see that individuals may have multiple viruses that are at play, but usually we don't see concomitant infections with EBV. EBV is sort of it's on its own thing. So in general, azithromycin is atypical to cause that type of rash.
Maybe one other question on treatment would be the role, if any, of corticosteroids for symptom relief or, you know, to kind of help address inflammation caused by EBV. Are we ever considering giving corticosteroids to help patients?
Yeah, you absolutely can. I mean, there's times where corticosteroids, in general, you don't need it. However, there are pretty clear indications for when you might want to use steroids. So I've seen some pretty fairly bad cases of significant exudative pharyngitis where the tonsils are huge and it causes an airway obstruction. So that's an indication where you may want to use steroids because symptomatic relief, besides that, an airway compromise is an issue. The other thing you may want to think about is in the case of perhaps severe cytopenia. So when we talked about very briefly the thrombocytopenia or a hemolytic anemia that may be associated with this, or the HLH that I mentioned before, actually corticosteroids is one of the cornerstones of therapy in those cases. But for the most part, we don't typically use it as a routine use in general.
And so, Sydney, why don't we go on to case number two?
All right, great. So let's jump into the second case where you are seeing 17-year-old Erica for her well visit. And when you ask if she has any questions, she notes that she's been feeling very tired lately, even though she sleeps about 9 hours a night. She did have a flu-like illness a couple of months ago, but she doesn't have any symptoms currently. You decide to include an EBV panel in your lab workup, which shows a negative IgM capsid antibody, but a positive IgG capsid antibody, a positive nuclear antigen, so that's the EBNA test, and a positive early antigen. Her WBC is 6.2. She also has a microcytic anemia, for which you're considering starting her on oral iron. She now wants to talk with you about her EBV lab results.
Okay, great. So, I mean, I think, so we'll just go back and just interpreting the results here. So first and foremost, she just want to re-level set where we're at. So we have a negative IgM viral capsid antigen, okay? We have positive viral, positive IgG viral capsid antigen. We have a positive, I think, EBNA, which we called the nuclear antigen. And we also have a positive early antigen. So what does that mean? So remember what we talked about earlier before. The IgM is usually the first one, antibiotic, and I'm just going to review this very quickly. The IgM is usually the first antibody that shows up unseen. It usually means that there's an acute infection. This particular antibody presents itself very early on in the infection, classically peaking around 2 weeks, but most definitely will be there until the fourth week of the infection after onset. Okay, so that will absolutely show you that it's an acute infection. But this is negative. So we're thinking, this might not be an acute infection. Let's keep looking. So now we have the positive IgG capsid antigen. And I mentioned this, IgG positive antibody can also be present very early on as well too, usually around that couple of weeks into the infection, but you'll see it peak around 6 weeks and it stays there lifelong. For the rest of your life, you'll have IgG. In fact, if we test anybody here today, you, myself, and Sydney, you'll find that you'll probably have IgG antibodies because, as I said, this is a very ubiquitous virus and almost everybody gets infected by the time they're in their teenage years. Okay, so the IgG tells me that there may have been a recent past infection or a remote infection. Now I have the nuclear antigen, that EBNA that I talked about. And remember, when I talked about the EBNA, it means that we see it on scene usually several weeks to several months out. So 6 to 6 months. Once you see that, that almost always tells you that this is a past infection. Okay. The early antigen can present whenever. So it's a plus minus whenever. Okay. So here, this suggests to me that this is a person who probably has had a past infection. And at minimum, the past infection, looking at the EBNA, may have been there as early as 6 weeks ago, more or less.
And with the history of all these symptoms a month or two ago, and maybe we can do a little bit more history taking, it sounds like this could suggest recovering from a recent infection, especially if when we quantify or did a follow-up, in theory, we could see if it's trending up or trending down. Though for this case, it might not be super relevant for the diagnosis, but we've now confirmed that the patient at the very least has been exposed to EBV either during this illness several months ago or prior.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about why that might be important. One of the small questions that we wanted to bring up in this too is the microcytic anemia, which we talked about, you know, can potentially be associated with a viral infection. We put her on oral iron, and I feel like infectious disease doctors have great opinions about when oral iron is safe. I don't want to anticipate, but, you know, in the recovery phase, presuming this is a recovery phase, do we feel comfortable with oral iron? But what if this were the acute phase? Would, you know, we feel like oral iron is safe to give in a patient with microcytic anemia and acute EBV, or we don't want to feed the virus, hold off on the oral iron? Thoughts on oral iron and EBV?
Yeah, I think the conventional teaching is that you don't typically give iron in a setting of an acute infection because of how it fuels the infection. And that's usually typically we see that in the setting of bacterial infections. However, I will say here that is you have to be very astute in this case. What is the anemia from? Right? And so essentially with EBV infection, it can be a longstanding infection for individuals. A couple of weeks they may have this, and usually they may have an associated anemia as we talked about before, and that can either be a normocytic to microcytic anemia. That normocytic to or microcytic anemia can be a, what we call anemia of chronic disease. And oftentimes that may be a constitution of the disease process itself, and in fact, not related to a true iron deficiency. And so in that case, rather than to put them on iron in the setting of an infection, and maybe in this particular case, this is a resolving infection, what really benefit does this have in this moment? Probably minimal. So most of us will probably not start on an iron-based therapy. It's not an acute thing that needs to be done right now anyway. So you can get away with actually doing iron studies to make yourself feel a little bit better. But in a case like this, probably not. And in fact, it is not part of the recommendations in terms of treatment in the setting of acute or past EBV-related infection.
That is very, very helpful in terms of just how we approach the anemia in the context of any infection, not just EBV. Kind of switching gears a little bit, let's say that Erica is like, okay, great, I've had mono, I can't get it again, right? Like, can you talk a little bit about what the protection is if you have antibodies?
Yeah. So if you have antibodies, though, IgG antibodies are lifelong. So they confer that level of protection. So those antibodies have what they call memory now. So anytime you may be exposed to EBV, as I said, it's pretty ubiquitous, it's everywhere. You may be exposed to it, but you may not mount another full-on infection as you just saw here. So yes, there is some level of protection that happens there, but here's the caveat. The caveat is you're a healthy individual. So if you're someone who is immunocompromised or a recent transplant on chemotherapeutic agents or even prolonged steroids that is really immunosuppressing you, you are likely to lose that level of protection. We also see it in other disease processes that can cause a protein losing nephropathy or protein losing enteropathy that will reduce your response to or circulating antibodies as well. So anything that is impairing your immune system more than likely will allow you to be exposed to the possibility of getting the infection again as if it was just a primary infection in the first place. And as I mentioned, because it affects B cells, particularly in B cells will go back to their home base in lymphocytic tissue. So for those who are immunocompromised, if they've had any history of primary infection as a child, and then they develop a what they call a lymphoma or Burkitt's lymphoma or a post-transplant lymphoma, it's the resurgence of the EBV in that lymphoid tissue. And that's where you don't have that protection because the immune system is not in check.
And can I ask about that too, as far as not just protection, so it sounds like you can lose protection and becoming immunocompromised, but with other herpes viruses, they can lay dormant and you can have recurrences and in the setting of stress or other things. Is that something too with EBV where you can get a reactivation of prior EBV infections?
So in an otherwise healthy individual, unlike the other herpes virus that you see with HSV-1 and HSV-2, no, it actually doesn't reactivate in a healthy individual. In the immunocompromised individual, that is exactly what we were talking about, that reactivation can happen. Absolutely.
And what about chronic forms of EBV? Oh. Is that a presentation, a chronic EBV?
So that's a great question because we get this question a lot in my clinic. So EBV has really not been substantiated by evidence that it is a cause of what we call the chronic fatigue syndrome. I want to be very clear about that. Now, that's very different. Let's distinguish that from you just had an EBV infection. which is the infectious mononucleosis, about 10% of individuals will progress to continue to have lingering symptoms, or what we call the post-infectious fatigue, in about 10%. But the concept of chronic fatigue syndrome has not been substantiated as an association or cause of EBV. So it's a little hard and frustrating for families. They're like, but yeah, but this is happening to me. And really the post-infectious part is not an ongoing EBV infection, because that's what we really want to communicate to our families. Because you're feeling this fatigue that you're feeling, that's not synonymous with ongoing viremia or ongoing virus circulating in your body. We have to be very clear in that messaging. And sometimes that's where a PCR test where it looks directly for the virus can help the family feel a lot better that you don't have circulating EBV in your body.
And thinking about some of the other big questions that I get with regards to EBV, can you talk a little bit more about some of these long-term complications? How do you respond to families who are anxious because they've read that, oh, there's a study that came out highlighting the connection between EBV and MS, or, you know, we know it's connected to these cancers. How do you respond to those concerns?
Yeah, I think validating the concerns of the family is incredibly important here, because what they're reading, yes, there is a reason why they're reading those things, because people are talking about their experiences, they're seeing studies that are being done. But I also always encourage the family to sort of talk about this in context of the individual. None of these things all happen in isolation. You have to have risk factors that might be associated with it as well too. And it also depends on the EBV that you're exposed to. So if you're someone who has underlying conditions, you might be exposed to various different manifestations of disease, including those who have HIV. What I saw a lot when I was overseas in Africa is what we call EBV or endemic Burkitt's lymphoma, which is very different in the US, which is sporadic Burkitt's lymphoma. Those sporadic, the name engenders that it just happens. There is really no predisposing factors for that at all, other than the fact that there may be an EBV association. So when I talk to families about this, when I see things like cancer and also MS, there are multiple different factors that are at play, and it's sort of the right time, the right ingredients, and a little bit of bad luck for individuals. But for the most part, most individuals don't manifest into these complicating factors that you see that we talk about with cancer and MS or any other autoimmune associated disease process.
One of the things we try to incorporate in every episode is integrating kind of health equity into each topic. And in the healthcare system where there's lots of health disparities and racial disparities, is this something that manifests in diagnosis and treatment of EBV and complications?
Yeah, I think that it's important. So while I mentioned earlier in the beginning that this is a virus that is not differential. It affects anyone, no matter their race and no matter their age, and no matter what their underlying condition is. But I think it's important, as particularly when it comes to fever, pain syndromes, that it's really important to think about this. And I can tell you, for pretty significant EBV as a particular case, and even a personal case of mine as well too, where we had an EBV case like this that has significant abdominal pain. And that was looked at very differently for certain individuals, because as you know, and what we know in terms of pain scales for particularly African-American individuals, that they tend to get less treated for pain scales as opposed to their non-African-American counterparts. So you want to take an eye that is keen, as if you were treating any other person that is there, and really manage their pain. And that particular case I'm talking about now actually had a splenic rupture due to EBV. So in a case like that, and it was worked up as just sort of the GI bug. So I would say that it's really important to sort of have an open lens, that anybody can be infected and take their pain very seriously, regardless of who they are.
This has been so helpful. And I feel like we've really covered the spectrum from presentation to diagnosis to kind of long-term approach and complications. Are there main take-home points that you think our listeners really should walk away from this episode with?
Yes. You may be listening to this, and it's great that you're listening to this, but know that you have resources out there. Do not feel like you cannot take a book and crack it open. And Google is there for you. And not that I'm encouraging my residents to just do Google. But I will say that is we are in an era of time that we have to be sort of these physicians that know anything and everything. And we don't have to. Use a resource like this, the CryptCiters here in this case, that is amazing to be able to furnish what lacks of knowledge that you may have. So I also tell readers, even for people like myself who've been doing this for 20 years, that book is my best friend. And so I guess that's probably the best advice I can give the listeners. I don't know.
I love that so much. I appreciate that. And I think about that all the time of that. I think sometimes medical training is just getting you really good at looking up
to date
and how to read it.
Yes.
And I think about with COVID, like none of us were trained in how to treat COVID.
Thank you.
But
yes.
You know, you raise to the I also love the idea of there's a bias, but of using the podcast to fill gaps.
Oh, my gosh.
And there was a wonderful sickle cell physician at Hopkins that I loved and just thought she was the absolute best, Sophie Landstron. And we asked her to do an episode on the podcast. And this was the Curbsiders Medicine. This is a long story, but I'll do it quick. And she was like, I guess, whatever, because she was just wanting to be supportive and helpful and was like, I don't know what this little podcast thing is. And then like 6 months later, she did the episode. 6 months later, someone came to do grand rounds and said exactly what you said, IJF. It's important to always be learning, to fill gaps. And in California, we never see sickle cell disease. But so I listened to the episode with Sophie Landstron and everyone applauded. And she was like, what is this? And that's when I was like, I like this podcast and it's working. So
this podcast is amazing. It's totally amazing. Oh my gosh.
Well, only because we did incredible people like you. And this has been this one of the most informative episodes. I think this is outstanding. And we just can't say thank you enough for your time, your expertise, your empathy, your compassion. And so thank you so much for coming on and sharing all these wonderful pearls with us. We really, really appreciate you.
Oh my gosh, I am so humbled at the opportunity. Thank you guys so much at keeping me on my toes and just doing the things that I like to do best, which is talking all things ID.
Love it. Well, thank you again. Thanks for coming on the Trip Siders. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
This has been another episode of the CribSiders.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes and sign up for our bi-weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player, or you can send us an email at thecribsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our producer for this episode, Sydney Engel, our talent recruiter for this episode, Jennifer Chisholm, our showrunner, Sam Mazur, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I've been Justin Lee Burke.
And I've been Sydney Engel. Thank you, and good night. And now, if you've made it to the end of this episode, I am not Chris the Chew Manchu, and so rather than a poem that is lengthy and read dramatically, I have a very short limerick. There once was a virus named Epstein, causing fatigue and glands to be swollen. With a kiss it would spread, leaving many in bed, but rest and time helped them be wellin. I think that AI is forcing it, but we'll hopefully have Chris back soon.
No judgment in art. We miss you, Chris.